Welcome to the SEDEFO podcast Skillset and Match. I'm Rosie Bouduri, and today's theme is SEDEFOP's second wave of the European Skills and Jobs Survey. The survey was conducted in the summer of 2021 in all EU member states, Iceland and Norway, and over 46,000 workers gave their views on how digitalization affects them, how their skills match with their jobs, and on their readiness to invest in continuous vocational training. There is now a consensus among policymakers and experts that shaping the future of work requires a skills revolution and action to address the so-called digital divides, where more vulnerable people, including inactive or retired and of certain socioeconomic background, lack basic digital skills. With 2023 being the European Year of Skills, the survey findings become even more important. SEDEFOP explored ways of powering the European digital transition in a high-level conference which acted as a curtain raiser for the year. In his keynote speech, European Commissioner for Jobs and Social Rights Nicolas Schmit stressed that the EU's policies focus on digital equality, with 170 billion euros of next-generation EU funds dedicated to digitalization. He highlighted SEDEFOP's role in the Year of Skills and the survey's valuable information for Europe's journey towards meeting its targets. Another keynote speaker, Nobel laureate economist Professor Christopher Pissarides, noted that digital technologies are opening up new avenues for progress which we can control, arguing that both companies and governments have an important role to play in achieving sustainable and inclusive growth through the provision of good jobs and restructured education and skills. With me to talk about all these issues are Manuela Prina, the European Training Foundation's Head of Skills Identification and Development Unit, Seamus McGuinness, Research Professor at Ireland's Economic and Social Research Institute, and Konstantinos Pouliakas, a SEDEFOP expert who has spent years working on the survey and analyzing its results. Welcome to all.
Good morning.
Good morning, Rosie.
Thank you. Good morning, Rosie.
I will start with Konstantinos, who will give us an overview of what the European Skills and Jobs Survey offers. How can the survey be used to support policy and benefit workers and employers, economies and societies?
What the second European Skills and Jobs Survey offers to policymakers is in-depth and unique evidence on the extent to which new digital technologies were taken up by the EU workforce at a time where we were all faced with a horrendous situation, early 2020 up to 2021, when we were suffering from the confinement and social distancing measures that were enforced because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So the survey provides unique insights into the extent to which EU workers had to quite quickly adapt and learn new digital technologies so that they could manage to retain their jobs. At the same time, as part of the survey, we get a lot of insight into the nature of the job tasks that people had to carry out. And finally, the survey also provides insight into the extent to which people felt that their skills were matched or mismatched to their jobs, and what type of education and training they had to undertake in order to mitigate any such skill mismatches. The survey is, to my knowledge, the first EU-wide data set which provides in-depth insights and informed insights into these type of phenomena.
What are the headlines, according to you, from the survey, the headline findings?
The headline findings are, of course, that around 35% of the EU adult workforce had to learn to work with new digital technologies during the first year of the pandemic. For some, that number is significant, but at the same time, if you flip it around, it basically means that 65% of the EU workforce did not have to learn to work with any new digital technologies. That also highlights that there is also a significant part of the EU workforce which is potentially insulated from these new ways of working and learning. And this, of course, raises a lot of concern. We found, for instance, that 1 in 8 EU workers do not work at all with computer devices as part of their jobs. And of course, the survey has highlighted that Even though digitalization has traditionally been considered to be a potential great equalizer, a medium that could potentially enable people who are excluded from forms of work, people who are in different regions and localities where work was not available, digitalization has always been considered to be an avenue to provide people with a lot of opportunity. And yet the survey has highlighted that there are and there continue to exist stark inequalities. We find that the digitally literate are those people who have benefited most from digital technologies, and those people who have traditionally been excluded from the benefits of digitalization during the first year of the pandemic continue to be excluded. So marked digital and social inequalities persist.
Which of the findings surprised you the most, and which was the most encouraging or discouraging?
In addition to the finding that I just mentioned, I would also add that we managed as part of the survey to measure for the first time the true level of skill demands. In the European Skills and Jobs Survey, we developed a specific methodology to measure the degree to which people have to read or write or solve problems or communicate as part of their jobs. We have found that as much as one in two EU jobs basically demand a relatively low level of skills.
That's a lot.
It's amazing if you think about it, but at the same time, it does not surprise me because we have had similar evidence from the United States. I think the survey really anchors our attention to these two sometimes opposite sides, a part of the labor market which is highly digitalized, highly skilled, but also a significant part of the labor market where workers are basically carrying out simple routine jobs. And in these simple routine jobs, skill mismatches, but in the form of skill underutilization, are fostered.
Let's go now to another set of countries outside the EU, in the neighborhood of the EU, as we say, that the European Training Foundation, CEDEFOP's sister EU agency, works with. Manuel, I would like to ask you why the ETF has decided to join the European Skills and Jobs Survey. What kind of synergies will that bring?
First of all, just for our audience to remind where we are implementing the survey. So we're implementing it in the Western Balkans, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, in Serbia, in Albania, in Kosovo, in North Macedonia, and in Israel, which is a country that has requested to join the survey. We go back to the issue of mismatch, which is an important dimension that labor markets and societies in our neighborhood are concerned about. The European Training Foundation has been working on skills mismatch since 2011. We think that the data we will have from implementing the survey will be extremely important to advise countries and also to look more in depth in the needs for the future, but also in particular for upskilling and reskilling of workers in the current labor market. The second point that I want to share is about the synergy between the EU and its neighborhood, which is gaining even more importance. I think we learn from the pandemic, but also from the attack to Ukraine, that the borders of the EU are not really meaningful when we talk about skills and when we talk about investments in human capital. And also our European skills agenda gives a lot of emphasis to the international dimension of that and the international work that the EU is putting forward. We think that having a common set of data will give to the European Union, as well as to partner countries, a common language, a common ground to discuss issues, to agree on priorities, and to put the investments and the cooperation for the future in a shared basis. Last point I want to mention is our shared future. We're really tied together in one family. And so more and more, together with CEDEFOP, but also with Eurofound, we will definitely go in the direction of ensuring that we work together to bring this dialogue even closer in the future.
as you said, these issues transcend borders. So what differences and similarities do the countries you're looking at have with the ones examined by SEDEF in the areas of skills and jobs?
There are many similarities, and also I would say that the impact of this digitalization on economies is very similar to what we observe in the European Union, at least for those countries that are part of the survey. And also the issue of, let's say, polarization of labor markets with some part of the labor market which is highly impacted by digitalization and requires a very quick update and gaining of skills, and a part of labor market which actually is at risk instead of exclusion, it's quite similar to the EU. But there are some issues that in our partner countries are more at stake. The first is youth unemployment, which is a great concern of partner countries and for which the European Union is working, in particular in the Western Balkans, through the support to youth guarantee schemes at the moment. And in some countries, the brain drain of young people is very high. A second issue is needs, people who are not in education or in training, which in some partner countries reaches even more than 30%. And the third issue that we have observed recently is the new forms of work, which are not really, I would say, yet on the radar of policymakers and also policy shapers, including employers association and trade unions.
Thank you for that, Manuela. Let's go back to skills mismatch, Seimus, which you presented at the SEDEFOP conference and which is a complex and multidimensional issue. Can you explain to our listeners in a few words what constitutes a skills mismatch?
Skills mismatches occur in a number of ways. We have vertical mismatches where the individual workers are perceived to have too much or too little education and skills for their jobs. And those phenomena like overskilling and over-education and underskilling and under-education are typically measured using labour force surveys or surveys like the European Skills and Jobs Survey. And it has been fundamental over the last number of years in really understanding those phenomena. And then we have vertical mismatches that are perceived from the firm perspective. This is where we have skill gaps, where the employer believes that their existing workforce do not have enough competencies to do the job. And that's sort of related to under-education and under-skilling. And then we have skill shortages, where the firm perceives that there is not enough qualified candidates external to the firm in the job market to fill the posts. We have other concepts, such as horizontal mismatch or field of study mismatch, where people are working in a job not related to their core education or degree area. And then we have skill obsolescence. So this is the phenomenon whereby skills become obsolete over time. That can be because the individual is no longer physically able to undertake the work. But more importantly, that skills become obsolete because of factors such as technological change, for example, and automation, where the tasks of the job are being replaced by new technology. So those are that's the sort of main spectrum of skill mismatches that we are concerned about from a policy perspective.
Why is it such a concern for policy?
If one in four of your workforce isn't being properly utilized, then that has a big impact potentially for productivity and for the economy as a whole. But it also has very negative impacts for individual workers, because we find that these mismatches are not transitory, that once you become mismatched, for example, overeducated and overskilled, you're likely to stay in that state for a particular length of time. And why people that are mismatched tend to move jobs more frequently, a lot of those moves are from one job in which they're mismatched to another job. So the implications for the individual worker are also significant, because we find that a lot of times they have lower levels of job satisfaction, they have lower earnings, and they tend to not progress in their occupation in terms of promotion.
Konstantinos, when presenting the survey findings at the conference, you said that many people who are susceptible to being impacted by digital technology in the future are oblivious to the fact. And these are usually low-skilled, working in low-level jobs. How can this be addressed?
What is interesting to observe is that these type of individuals tend to be in occupations which other part of the literature has typically found as being at higher risk of potential automation. So this is why I think it's something that should be an issue of concern, because I make the argument that for policymakers reaching out to this part of the population, informing them better about the potential automation risk that they face, informing them about how they can potentially be doing their jobs, but in a different manner, one which would potentially involve the adoption of new digital technologies. Even very simple jobs can be improved with the use of digital technologies. So reaching out to these people and informing them that there is a way that can improve you, you can do your job faster, you can do your job in a less hazardous way, can have lots of benefits. And it's up to policymakers and social partners to provide this information and to help people embrace these new forms of working. It's a challenge, of course, because a lot of people resist. A lot of people tend to feel that, okay, I've been doing the same job in the same way for many years. I mean, who are you to tell me now that I should be changing my standard way of working? It's an educational process.
I see Manuela and Seamus nodding, and I would like to ask Manuela, how difficult or maybe easy is it to raise awareness, to change these mindsets?
It's very difficult. When we look at the target that EU has of reaching 60% of adults accessing continuous training and lifelong learning by 2030, in our partner countries, we don't even have the data of access, so we cannot even establish a baseline and actually an objective, but it's definitely very low. We cannot say, and we will never say, that because the majority of jobs in fact require simple skills, we should not educate people. This would be the end of democracies and the end of human capital development. Because to be able to navigate in societies, you will need more and more complex skills.
Following on from that, a question for all of you. Professor Pissarides observed at the CEDEFOP conference that inequality is high and not falling, as we've also said here. Many jobs created for the less skilled are not good. Again, we've said that. And there is evidence of use of digital technologies for political purposes. What are your thoughts on this and how can it be remedied? Let's start with Manuela.
I think it's important that we always stress that jobs should be decent and quality of jobs should be a priority. And this is also for very simple jobs. And unfortunately, we are very far from ensuring this.
What does it take to ensure this, as you said?
It takes responsibility from policymakers, and it takes responsibility for all social partners that need to put forward the measures and the control system, as well as the incentives and the conditions to involve all workers in opportunities. It's incentives, it's motivation, it's the quality of HR, it's career guidance, it's orientation, it's support to families. There are many policy dimensions that enter into the picture. So we need to protect those who have less skills and to ensure that they also have opportunities.
Seamus?
Yeah, I think there is a concern that inequality is rising over time and that there may be a reduction in the quality of jobs at the more basic level. But this is not something that governments and agencies have no control over. That's why we have minimum wage legislation. When you set a minimum wage, that automatically sets a floor, which I suppose the quality of jobs cannot sort of decline. In terms of labour regulation, you know, in terms of regulating contracts, banning 0 hours contracts, also the type of industrial policy that a country pursues in terms of the foreign direct investment that it tries to attract into the country, and also the industrial policy in terms of how they stimulate their indigenous employment and growth. So those are all choices that states and countries can make and agencies can make that can ensure that the quality of jobs is maintained at a certain level. It is not inevitable that job quality will always decline, and it is not inevitable also that digitalization and automation will necessarily result in a decline of job quality. We just don't know enough about it at the moment. The work that Costas and I did showed that where digitalization and automation was taking place, it was actually at the higher end of the labour market spectrum, and it was replacing tasks within jobs there. But what is certain is that digitalization and automation is a growing facet of the labour market, and it is growing right throughout the labour market. And we really need to understand how it is impacting jobs right across the job distribution, but particularly at the lower end of the labour market, because not only does it affect the policies that we have there to protect workers, but it also impacts the extent to which we can help people who are outside the labour market in terms of the unemployed or people who are inactive. So if we don't know enough about the digital competencies that are being required, particularly at the labour market entry point and those entry level jobs, then policy falls down right across the board. But I don't accept the premise that digitalisation will necessarily result in an increased job polarisation and a deterioration of the position of workers at the lower end of the labour market. As I said, there are institutional and frameworks and legislation that can be implemented by countries to prevent that. So the extent to which countries want to deregulate their labour markets and reduce minimum wages and allow that to happen, that's a choice. It's not an inevitability for policy.
And what about skills mismatch? Can we ever achieve the perfect skills match?
No. There will always be skill mismatches. Even if the demand and the supply side of the economy are perfectly in balance in terms of quantity, information gaps and information asymmetries will always result in people ending up in the wrong jobs and employers hiring the wrong people for particular jobs. But we can smooth that transition, and we know lots of information about the importance, for example, of matching institutions, particularly within third level. So if the universities, for example, play an active role in terms of career services or job placements, that can smooth the incidence of graduate mismatch. We also know that the content of provision is important, that the more practical job-related skills that and competencies that students get, particularly at university, again, that's an important factor in reducing the incidence of mismatch. And particularly if they have work placements as part of the degree programme, again, that's important. But if you're not improving the quality of jobs on the other side of the demand side of the equation, as we've spoken about, there's going to be limitations to the extent to which you can reduce skill mismatches just by purely supply side policies. Because if there is an issue, for example, that job quality is not increasing as educational provision is increasing, then mismatches become somewhat inevitable.
And Konstantinos, briefly?
I've been thinking since the time of the conference, what did Professor Pissarides mean when he said that digital technologies are being used for political purposes? And I think it comes down to the fact that looking also back to the previous industrial revolutions, when you're having such waves of innovation, this is synonymous to huge social unrest happening, and it also provokes a social struggle. So you can either go down the route of having digital technologies which will empower capital, where you will be observing that more and more companies are using technologies to replace labor. But then what we have seen also in previous revolutions has been the labor revolting, social dialogue being accentuated over time, and workers essentially demanding a piece of the pie. Through that process, we may eventually find ourselves in a couple of years where workers will have been empowered. We will see better social outcomes because of the introduction of these new digital technologies. But we need to be wary of the fact that this process and this social struggle, as I call it, can be very, very long, can even take decades. And during these decades, we are likely to see lots of social unrest. We are likely to see huge inequalities being accentuated. We are likely to see technological companies becoming dominant and taking decisions which traditionally have been the preserve of governments. We're going to have to struggle until we reach some outcome and some new equilibrium where we will be able to ensure that workers and individuals are also benefiting. And to do so, we shouldn't accept technological determinism as being a de facto situation. It's not the case that the advent of digital technologies should dictate how societal progress will unfold. It's up to us as policymakers, as worker associations, as social partners who will have to shape and discuss how we would like our future society to be and how to ensure what we have called in the European Skills and Job Survey report a human-centered digital transition.
Very important this, and also the fact that we are faced with a liquid situation where we have to be on our toes all the time to deal with the new challenges that come up. There's already a lot for our listeners to take in. So I'd like to thank all our guests today, ETF's Manuela Prina, Professor Seamus McGuinness, and CEDEFOP's Konstantinos Pouliakas for this interesting chat.
Thank you, Rosie.
Thank you, Rosie.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more on vocational education and training, skills and qualifications. Until then, you can visit our website, cedefop.europa.eu, for the latest developments. You can also find our podcasts there and on all major podcast platforms. And you can follow us on social media. Goodbye.